This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today, we're bringing you the story of a young woman who was tortured in one of the most brutal and sadistic murders you'll ever hear about. Her body goes unidentified for decades until a persistent detective finds something that surprises everyone, even himself.
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Our story begins on a hot, humid day in August of 1986. The weather's oppressive, but there's an air of happy anticipation in the car as a young couple from Philly drives south on the Atlantic City Expressway. The weekend is just starting, and they're on their way to New Jersey to check on the construction of their new house in Buena Vista Township. They're excited to see the progress, but when they arrive at the property, their excitement turns to horror. Not far from the house, they discover the body of a dead girl. Now, this is the 80s. Not everyone has a cell phone. So they rush back to their car and they drive to the nearest payphone to call police. Detective Taylor Bonner of the New Jersey State Police wasn't at the original scene back in 86, but he's in charge of the case today, and he's visited the location in recent years. He told me just how remote it is.
How this property is located, it's kind of like dirt roads that lead to it. If I didn't know the area, like without knowing where I had to go, I would have never located this, where this house was located. It's a dirt road that leads down. You have to go over a railroad track and down the dirt road. This couple ended up checking on their house, and that's when they discovered the body in the back right corner of their property. That's when they notified law enforcement.
As Detective Bonner described, the property is quite remote, and it's clear to police that the killer took advantage of that fact. Or he chose that location because of it. He wasn't worried about being discovered, and if it was there where the attack occurred, no one would hear the screams of his victim during the savage assault. Whoever killed her took his time.
I've never seen anything like it. Even throughout all these crime scene pictures that we've seen throughout all these cold cases and any other cases, it's just so hard to describe how brutal and intense it was what they did to her.
Now, I want to warn you that the description of the torture the victim endured is disturbing. Here's Detective Bonner.
It was brutal. Her arms were bound with pipe hangers, like copper pipe hangers. There was caustic acid poured all over her body, on her face, on her chest. The way she was positioned is because of the copper pipe hangers that were behind her neck. Her arms basically dislocated and were behind her head and back above her head. It was brutal.
I asked Detective Bonner if he had a theory on how her arms became dislocated.
So there was fabric wrapped around her legs that appears that she was dragged from one area to another. The cloth was tied around her legs, we assume to not touch the acid around her upper body. So the tied around her legs and dragged that way to her final resting spot.
Detective Bonner told us that the victim, found lying on her back with her arms bound behind her, appeared to have been fully clothed, though some of her clothing had been eaten away by the acid poured onto her chest, leaving her breasts exposed. The caustic substance was later determined to be sulfuric acid, which is highly corrosive. So not only was her clothing eaten away, but wherever the acid made contact with her face and chest, the skin in those areas began to peel away as well. It would be determined that she was still alive when she was doused with the acid. Investigators did not find any sulfuric acid containers or a murder weapon at the scene, and there was no attempt to bury the body. I was curious if detectives thought the crime was sexually motivated. Police said that is a possible theory, but no evidence of a sexual assault could be determined.
Her pants were fully buttoned. But like we said, it's too hard to determine because of the way the shirt was. It could have been ripped off or it could have been destroyed from the acid. That's just something we weren't able to tell.
And as Detective Bonner mentioned, the victim's wrists had been restrained by copper pipe hangers, the kind used in home construction, but they did not appear to have come from the house being built at that location. And there was nothing to indicate that any part of the assault and murder occurred within the house. Detectives scour the scene for evidence, and the body is removed to the coroner's office. The victim is a white female, 18 to 24 years old. She's 5'6 to 5'7, 115 pounds, with brown hair. She has pierced ears and was wearing a blue Varsity House brand pullover sweater, Sergio Valente blue jeans, and gray size 8 high-top sneakers. Orthodontic brackets were in her mouth, which indicated that she had braces or retainers at some point. Since no ID was found and she doesn't fit the description of any missing person in the Buena Vista area at the time, she's classified as Jane Doe. When the autopsy results come back, the cause and manner of death are determined to be from multiple stab wounds and asphyxiation from sulfuric acid. The victim also suffered a fractured skull, and her face and chest are disfigured from the acid. Detective Bonner said that this was a truly gruesome crime.
It was brutal. Yeah, you had to have some sort of rage to do that.
Because it's so remote, a canvas of the area doesn't bring any leads. And without an ID, the investigation hits a wall. But in January 1988, the case takes a turn. But that turn won't be evident for 14 more years. Let me explain. So in January 1988, about a year and a half after Buena Vista Jane Doe's discovered, police in Bensalem, Pennsylvania discover the body of another girl in a well at the abandoned Publicker Distillery. That body is also unidentified, and she's dubbed Publicker Jane Doe. I know it's not making sense yet, but stick with me. Now let's fast forward 14 years later. Both of the Jane Doe cases we talked about have gone cold. It's now 2002, and Lieutenant Christopher McMullen of the Bensalem PD is assigned to light duty due to an injury. He's handed a couple of cold case files, and he digs right into the top file, which is labeled Tracy Byrd. Tracy's a 14-year-old girl who went missing back in March 1983. Detective McMullen works the case for years, poring through the files. As part of his investigation, he looks at Jane Doe's in the area that might fit the description of Tracy Byrd. He comes across Publicker Jane Doe found in the well in Bensalem 2.5 years after Tracy went missing. And guess what? Tracy is also from Bensalem. Here's Detective McMullen.
Right away, I'm thinking it's Tracy Byrd. Everything on that fit. The body was about, give or take, a mile from where Tracy lived. It was found about a mile in her hometown. And so I'm like, I'm going to ID this girl. This is Tracy Byrd. And we're going to, you know. So obviously, you know, I track down all of Tracy Byrd's family and I get DNA from all of them that I can.
While he's waiting for the results, he gets a possible lead from another detective.
I was told that she may be a different missing girl named Jeanette Tambe, T-A-M-B-E. So I started doing my homework on Jeanette Tambe. And she was a girl that went missing in October of 1984 from Bensalem. And she was 18 at the time. Both her parents were deceased. And it was my understanding they had been cremated. So even if I could get the money to do an exhumation, which was not an easy task, I have done one exhumation and I had to beg, borrow, and steal to get the money to do that. In this case, I found that she had a brother named Joseph. And it took me a while to track him down. He was originally, I was told he was living in South Philly, but I couldn't find him in South Philly. And ultimately, I found him in a town outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania, called Nanticoke, little borough outside of Scranton. Couldn't get a phone number for him, so I contacted him the old-fashioned way. I mailed him a letter.
McMullen feels like he could be on the right track, so he continues tracking down people who were close to Jeanette.
While at the same time, there was a woman named Joanne Fox. Joanne was a friend of Jeanette's. She was a neighbor, and she was kind of like a surrogate mother to her. She was older, and I had met with Joanne a few times. She was living in Philadelphia. You know, she had told me, you know, Jeanette had a very bad relationship with her mother, and then she was close with her father. Her father passed first. And apparently she had a boyfriend that was very abusive, and her life was just really in a state of disarray. But Joanne was genuinely concerned about her. I showed Joanne pieces of the jewelry that were found with the body, and she didn't recognize them. You know, her answer was, well, maybe they are Jeanette's, maybe they're not, I don't know. You know, obviously I'm going there saying, I want them to say that's her ring or that's her necklace. Unfortunately, it didn't happen.
McMullen finally hears back from Jeanette's brother, Joseph.
And he did call me back, and we spoke. And I told him about the publicar body. And I talked with him, and I asked him, you know, can I meet with you? So I drove out to see him. I remember it was in October of 09. And I remember that because I was listening to the Yankees and the Phillies play in the World Series. So I met with him, and I showed him the clothing and the jewelry. And again, he did not recognize it either. He was very forthright with me. He said, I had just gotten out of the military back then. I was doing some heavy drinking, and I really, you know, I wasn't really that involved in my family's life at the time. And apparently, you know, Jeanette was known for bumming money off of people and never paying them back. And, you know, it seemed as though they didn't have the greatest relationship during that time. She had a couple cousins in South Philly that she had lived with, but apparently they had kind of gotten annoyed with her because she had done the same thing with borrowing money and never returning it. So anyway, one day, just, you know, Jeanette never showed up anywhere, and she was never seen again.
So Lieutenant McMullen takes the next step.
So I got, a buccal swab, a DNA sample from her brother, and I send that in to CODIS. So I'm thinking, okay, you know, I'm still thinking it might be Tracy Byrd, but I didn't have those answers yet. But I'm thinking, all right, well, maybe it's Jeanette Tambi. Again, it's close. The timeline is right because, you know, when both Tracy and Jeanette went missing, 83 and 84, and the Jane Doe, she was estimated at having been there for 3 to 5 years. So I'm thinking, okay, I'm in the right time parameters that this Jane Doe died. Could be either one of these girls.
The DNA results come back from Tracy Byrd's family, and it's not a match. It's not Tracy. You can hear all about Tracy's case in our episode called Family Secrets. So to say that Detective McMullen is surprised by the DNA findings is an understatement, but he's still waiting on the DNA results from Jeanette Tambi's family.
A couple months go by, and I remember I got to work, and there was a letter on my desk from the Center for Human Identification. And literally, as I'm opening the letter, my phone rings, and it was them. And they called me and said, you know, we got a mitochondrial hit on your family reference DNA sample for Joseph Tambi. And I'm like, that's it. That's Jane Doe. I know who she is.
Finally, a match. But it's not the match he was expecting.
And they're like, yeah, she's a Jane Doe that was found in Buena Township, New Jersey in August of 1986. And I'm like, what?
So Jeanette Tambi is not publicer Jane Doe, who was found in the well. But because Ben Salem police tested the DNA sample from Jeanette Tambi's family, that reference sample was put into CODIS, the national DNA database, used not only to compare to unsolved crimes, but to unidentified human remains as well. And that DNA sample was identified to New Jersey's Jane Doe, found by the young couple at the beginning of our story. She finally has a name, Jeanette Tambi. At this point, publicer Jane Doe is still unidentified, and you can listen to our episode called Girl in the Well for more details on that case. So back to the DNA match from the Tambi family. There's a slight snag. Jeanette's identification is based on her brother from mitochondrial DNA. The medical examiner won't sign off on the identity without a nuclear DNA confirmation. Lieutenant McMullen goes back to one of the original detectives on the case.
Mitochondrial say, you know, there's siblings, there's an association. But nuclear is, from what I understand, is like mother to child, and it's 100% versus mitochondrial, which is like a you might have the same parent, one common parent and that sort of thing. So again, I said, well, from what I understand, the parents are both deceased and cremated. There's one sibling and we already have his DNA. So how is this going to work out? I contact the original investigator that had told me about her, and I tell him what's going on. And very casually, he says to me, well, why don't you just give them the blood that I took from her mother back in 1985? And I kind of laughed. And I said, what blood? What are you talking about? And he said, well, back in, you know, after she had been missing for a while, he said, I took a couple vials of mom's blood in the event something ever came up. I'm not going to pull punches here. This was before we had computers there. And some of the bookkeeping wasn't that great. You know, the case file that I had did not have a property receipt saying, you know, on such and such a date, two vials of blood were taken from Joy Tamby. That was her name. The mother's name was Joy. And I didn't see anything indicating that. He still had a copy of it. He was working at another agency, and he showed up the next day with the property receipt. It's like 28 years later, and the Bensalem police had moved. We weren't even in the same building we were in back in the early 80s. I took the property receipt, and I walked it down to our evidence custodian, and I kind of rolled my eyes, and I was like, can you see if you have this, you know, thinking I'm going to get laughed at. And honest to God, 5 minutes later, he comes back, and he hands me two vials of blood. I ought to play the lottery, because what were the chances, right? And I said, I can't believe this, but we have blood from Jeanette Tamby's mother. So I call the New Jersey State Police. I run the blood right to their lab, and they get to work on it, and boom, we get 100% match. So we now have indisputable proof that Jane Doe is indeed Jeanette Tamby. You know, she's declared Jeanette Tamby by the coroner, and the New Jersey State Police then, you know, obviously had jurisdiction on the homicide.
After 26 years, New Jersey State Police have a significant lead in their homicide case on the now confirmed identity of Jeanette Tamby. But the big question is, who killed her? Because of the items used in the murder, like the copper pipe hangers to bind the victim's wrists and the sulfuric acid poured on her, we asked if they thought that her killer might have construction or plumbing experience. Here's Detective Taylor Bonner.
So we have a few suspects. Some are deceased, some are still alive. We have to keep an open mind on the suspect because of like the remote location. So that could mean someone local, but then it's, why was Jeanette in Buna versus in Philly? And what type of lifestyle? And I feel like that's the toughest part, to try and discover a suspect or determine who the suspect is or who would commit this.
I asked if the crime suggested any other theory.
The aspect, the type and the detail of how she was murdered and everything that was done to her body, it seems like it was someone that wanted revenge of some way, shape, or form. It wasn't just someone that you have to feel that person at least knew her for a split second, you know, that something happened and it wasn't just, you know, like a random occurrence.
Police have checked for homicides and assaults with similar MOs, especially those involving torture and the use of acid, but nothing that has brought them closer to an arrest if their suspect is even still alive. But another challenge in this case is Jeanette's lifestyle. She was a free spirit. She lived on the streets from time to time, and other than one sighting by a cousin in Philly in July 1986, they really don't know where she was between the time she was initially reported missing by her family in 1984 and when her body was discovered at that house construction site in August 1986.
That's just unknown. But like we said, it's not that far of a distance. You know, it's not like she's in Bensalem and found in California. It's an hour and a half or so to get to that area. It might maybe less. So it could have just been like a common thing. She jumped on the bus and went. But like we said, like talking to the brother, it wasn't because of her lifestyle. They weren't really worried when she went missing. Like, yes, she went missing, but at the same time, like, oh, she's either with her boyfriend wherever or doing this. Like, oh, she'll be back. She's a fighter. And that was the attitude she always had. And her brother even said that when we spoke to him, that Jeanette was someone that wouldn't take lightly to like anyone trying to, you know, confront her or do anything. So she would definitely fight back, is what he said. So that might also be the reason whatever happened to her, you know, whatever led to it, maybe it was something that she was fighting back. You know, they tried to, you know, approach her and, you know, and because she's, I guess she defends herself well and she's used to that transient lifestyle, that she put up a good fight. And that's what kind of led to the extra activity of the acid and the burns and the stab wounds and all that.
Police will tell you that in any homicide investigation, one of the first places they look is at the relationships between the victim and others close to them. I asked Detective Bonner if the boyfriend, who had a prior criminal history, was a person of interest.
He's not someone we didn't rule out. Unfortunately, he's deceased now. So that was another situation, is based on reports that he was down in Florida. Did she take the bus down to Florida? Obviously, if she did, she came back. But he was interviewed. He gave his statements. of her and him that they had seen each other throughout the time. But other than that, he didn't admit to anything that would have or give any information that helped us when it came to what happened to Jeanette.
Police are also scrutinizing other possible persons of interest, as well as using advancements in DNA technology.
We have some evidence right now sent out to private labs for this case specifically, and we're still waiting to hear back. Obviously, the acid will hinder and hurt us from getting a clean sample, but there's obviously certain spots that the acid didn't touch. Obviously, anything the acid touched, you're more than likely not getting DNA from. But the other articles that we sent out for private lab testing, we're still waiting to hear back from if there is a profile that we're going to be able to get from.
The biggest obstacle in the investigation seems to be the lack of information on her day-to-day life. As we said, detectives don't know where she was, who she was with, or what she was doing during the days and hours leading up to her murder. What they do know is that Jeanette's brother last saw her in October 1984, and she was with her boyfriend. Jeanette's cousin last saw her in July 1986 in Philadelphia, also with her boyfriend. And police say that the boyfriend was in Florida at one point. Did Jeanette go with him or follow him there?
This transient lifestyle, did she get a new job that led her out that way? Did she meet someone that brought her that way out of Philly? Or did she travel there and then end up meeting someone? There's a lot of different circumstances. It would be a lot easier to kind of narrow down the type of suspect if she had a more consistent lifestyle.
New Jersey State Police would like to solve this case to give answers to the family and justice for Jeanette.
There's no closure. We know that. There's never closure with any homicides, whether they're solved or not. But it gives you an answer. It gives answers of why, what happened, why it happened. And sometimes that's good enough for families. And if any bit of peace that you can bring these families, that's for any of these cold cases, is why we do it.
For Detective Bonner, delving into an old investigation is like reliving the steps that his colleagues took years earlier.
It's like a time capsule. You know, you're going through these old cases, and it's a credit to the old detectives. Like, you know, you see the work they did, and like, they didn't know DNA was going to ever be a thing. They didn't know genealogy would be out there, things like that. So the little things like that, it makes you realize how important, you know, every little detail is. Because you look back on it, you're like, oh, only if they knew this, they could have done that. But at the same time, they did so much that even gives you an opportunity to, you know, to test this evidence or people to speak to.
This is still an open case for the New Jersey State Police, and they tell me that it will remain open until there's a resolution. For now, they want to refine the timeline as much as possible.
If anyone has known Jeanette throughout any of the time, or they worked with her, or they knew she got a new job, or she has new friends, or anything, any bit of information is helpful. Whether you knew Jeanette in 1980, 1984, 1986, anything, just to help retrace, you know, her steps. And that little bit of information might help us lead to a suspect. It's great to put handcuffs on people, but realistically, it's about the victims and their families, and it's solving those and closing the cases out for that aspect of it.
If you have any information about the murder of Jeanette Tambi or anything that can help detectives develop a better timeline as to her whereabouts or relationships between 1984 and 1986, call the New Jersey State Police at 1-833-4-NJ-COLD or email coldcase@njsp.gov.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.